You might not have heard about the Council of Great Lakes Region, CGLR, but they're worth knowing about. Serving a shared Canadian-U.S. population of over 103 million people, this nonprofit shepherds binational collaboration and action around everything from infrastructure modernization to climate resilience to public health to sustainable business and more. I talked with the CEO, Mark Fisher, and the Senior Director of Business and Sustainability, Laura Schrake, to understand how they're effectively tackling this huge, diverse, and impactful mission and vision. And now I give you Mark Fisher and Laura Schrake from CGLR. Mark Fisher and Laura Schrake from the Council of the Great Lakes Region, welcome to the Nonprofiteers Podcast.
Nice to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to see you both. Well, I was excited about CGLR, and I think we can call it that when my staff brought it to me, because you guys have one of the most amazing mandates I've ever seen. I think it includes economic growth, environmental protection, and individual well-being, which is you're cutting a broad swath. So I was very interested in interviewing you guys.
Thanks, Chip.
Yeah. So let me start by asking you how Council of the Great Lakes Region got started, how it was founded.
Yeah, great question, Chip. So our journey really started about 10 plus years ago. At the time, the U.S. Canadian ambassadors, David Jacobson and Gary Doer, respectively, were really wanting a forum in the Great Lakes region, which is shared by the two countries, but Ontario and Quebec and eight Great Lakes states, New York to Minnesota. They wanted a forum that would bring together the region's various perspectives and interests across industry, all levels of government, academia, the broader nonprofit sector, to really think more strategically about the Great Lakes region as a shared economy. And how do we work together across borders and sectors to improve the region's long-term economic success and competitiveness? But also, how do we work together to protect the Great Lakes, the world's largest freshwater system? And how do we protect the environment for future generations? And, you know, I think as a result of that desire, that request, a number of folks at the time sort of convened different experts to look at what would be the right kind of body or mechanism to create in the Great Lakes region. And they quickly turned to an organization that's existed at West now for, I think, close to 30 years, called the Pacific Northwestern Economic Region, which has been a great platform for bringing the states and provinces and other interests together to talk about shared cross-border issues. And so ultimately, that was the model that we chose to create the Council of the Great Lakes Region, or CGLR. And it formally started in 2013. I became its first CEO in 2014, shortly after it was launched, after 18 plus years working for the Government of Canada in what would be the executive office of the White House for a number of years. Our journey has been an interesting one, but that was our starting point.
Wow. So your mandate was broad right from the very beginning.
It was, very much so. And when you look at the United States and Canada, that economic environmental agenda, it is very different and quite complex in their own rights. You know, when we're thinking about the economy and trade, I think we often forget that when you put the eight states and two provinces together, it represents roughly a $6 trillion economy in U.S. dollars.
Right.
You know, that would make it the third largest economy in the world if it was a country, believe it or not. It supports roughly 50 million jobs in both countries. So that's one third of the combined Canadian-American workforce. And it's a region that's responsible for over 50% of the total value of goods traded back and forth between the two countries every year. You know, with 25% of that trade going across one bridge, the Ambassador Bridge between Detroit and Windsor. Mm-hmm. So that trading relationship, that economic relationship is complex in its own right. And really looking at, you know, how do we create more economic success and competitiveness together? You know, and just as an example of that, you know, the St. Lawrence Seaway, which really connects the world from a marine commerce standpoint to North America's heartland, was built in the 60s, but it's a system that's running at about 50% capacity right now. So when you look at that decarbonization agenda, that trade agenda, how do you use the Seaway more effectively to move goods out of this region to world markets, but from world markets into this region? That's just one example of the economic issues that we give a lot of thought to. And what's the future of mobility? The Great Lakes auto sector, the auto industry was created in the Great Lakes region. But as you know, that region and that sector is changing at lightning speed. So how do we continue to lead the future of mobility in the auto sector? And so there are many economic sectors that we think about. And then equally on the environment side, the health of the Great Lakes, we're still very much cleaning up industrial contamination pollution from the 50s, the 60s, the 70s in many ways. And as we continue to do that and protect the health of the Great Lakes, how are we thinking about new and emerging challenges like plastic waste and plastic litter, or issues like climate change and coastal resiliency and climate change risk? And, you know, as the world changes as a result of climate change, how many people are going to move to this region as a result of that because of its more agreeable climates, access to water, livable cities? So there's some big issues on the environment side that we are trying to pay attention to as well, and sort of look around the corner again on both the economic environment side and provide business and government and others the best advice, the best insights possible in terms of how does this region continue to succeed into the future.
Yeah, I just wish you guys were a little bit more ambitious.
Well, we are. I would say in our new strategic plan, our big ambition is to make the Great Lakes region the first sustainable region in North America and the world. So it's a vision that really brings the economy and the environment much closer together in our work. I think trying to become the first sustainable region in the world and to do that in a binational region, I think that's super ambitious.
Yeah, both of those elements, along with the element, and I didn't know this, that the Greater Lakes region is the largest freshwater body in the world. Along with that, that would be quite a model for sustainability and climate viability if you guys were able to do that. It's a great mandate. Yeah. So the mission and vision, I think you incorporated it a little bit there. Talk a little bit about in your mandate, it says economic growth, environmental protection, and individual well-being. Talk about the individual well-being. I'm assuming that's kind of associated with the economic factors and the climate factors.
You know, this region's home to roughly 107 million people. Again, if you were to think of that in country terms, that would make this region the 12th largest country in the world by population. There's a significant number of families and workers that depend on this region for jobs. But we know that the economy of the past and the economy of late, particularly coming out of the housing crisis in 2008, the pandemic 2020, people have experienced that economic development, that economic growth in very different ways, right? And so for us, it's trying to think about as we grow the economy, how do we make sure that we're thinking about individual well-being and prosperity, and that everyone has an opportunity to fully participate in the economy of today, but more importantly, the economy of the future. And that hasn't always been a top of mind issue for government policymakers and for business. So it's just making sure that we're keeping an eye on those issues around individual prosperity and well-being. Ultimately, it's also tied to the environment. We know that when we have livable cities, when we have clean cities, that's good for individual well-being. And you know, safer cities, all of those things, you know, are part of what we are trying to think about when it comes to that sustainable future. So it's the economy, it's people, it's the protection of our environment.
Yeah. So Mark, you got started, you were in the Canadian government, right? Before you
Correct.
Became CEO. And Laura, how about you? How did you get started and what's your position now?
Yeah, well, I work as a senior program director for business and sustainability with the council. I've been working in the nonprofit space for nearly 15 years with the council for the last 2.5 years, engaging businesses across the region on sustainability issues that are material to them and their business. Prior to that, I was running a small national nonprofit organization in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, that was focused on sustainable development, catering to the construction and building industry. And it was a membership-based organization, similar to the way the Council of the Great Lakes region works. It was trying to engage businesses and other stakeholders to come together on topics important to that geography. And so with the Council of the Great Lakes region, it's been really exciting engaging businesses that are working across the region, either headquartered or having significant operations to the region, and connecting them to that regional perspective. So many will oftentimes look at the global ambitions or local where they're headquartered, but really bringing in that regional conversation. So that's been quite an exciting opportunity since joining the council in 2021.
Great. You've both alluded to partnerships. Talk a little bit about who your important partners are and how you forge partnerships. I can't imagine with a mandate as broad as yours and as impactful that partnerships are not, you know, absolutely critical.
Well, maybe I can start at a high level and Laura can talk about it from a programming perspective, but at a high level, when we think about the economy, the environment, when we think about sustainability and sustainable development, government is a tremendous, you know, is such an important partner from a policy making regulatory side of things, right? So how do we engage them in a meaningful way? And that's all levels of government. It's cities, it's states, provinces, it's the two federal governments. Businesses, obviously, through their strategies, their investments, their operations, is a critical voice and partner and collaborator in the conversation around sustainability. And it's reminding them that it's not just about environmental protection, it's the economy, it's people. But obviously, that's a critical partner to have at the table, to have their perspective shared on, you know, how they see the path forward. And then next, you know, from a higher education standpoint, you know, we have one of the largest clusters of higher education in the world, right? And some of the, you know, sort of leading research institutions. And there's a tremendous amount of thinking and research that goes into these issues, but it doesn't always get into the domains in public policy discussions and debates or in front of business leaders. So we serve as a great translation point where we can bring some of that emerging science and understanding into this conversation around business strategy and policy making, right? So obviously the universities and colleges are an important partner. And then lastly, environmental groups and activists and making sure that we have sort of a complete perspective in, you know, with industry and government at the table. And that is a healthy tension, right? And it's trying to create that forum with all those different perspectives and interests where we can share in a conversation about our concerns, but more importantly, try to envision what a different future might look like. And ultimately, how do we work together on trying to achieve that future? And I think the traditional way of doing business is you fight it out in the corridors of state assemblies or Congress. And it's full of tension. It's full of conflict. And this is a work in progress. But I think the collaborative forums that we're trying to create, I think, are a better way of creating policy or a better way of creating more sustainable business, more sustainable cities, more sustainable jobs, protecting the environment. I think the proof is in the pudding. I think with time, we'll see if that theory of change is right in terms of how do we create that more collaborative environment where we can think about these big issues from a regional perspective, but we can also work together on solving them.
Right. So again, given the big mandate, where do you draw the line between in-house resources and external resources that you have to rely on? So for example, for your program work, do you have environmental experts on board on your staff at CGLR, or do you rely more for external parties, academic institutions, whoever?
For a pretty small team in-house, we do rely quite a bit on our partners and other stakeholders across the region. One of our strategic priorities is around building our community. And that includes, as Mark mentioned, government sector, academic partners, other nonprofit organizations, and the business community. And so we tap into the expertise that already exists within the region. We know that there's a wealth of knowledge here in our backyard. And so we really tap into that. That's part of the engagement process. And I guess also in terms of the partnerships, I'm echoing a little bit of what Mark said, but, you know, we have a very big region that we are looking at. Mm-hmm. And so in order to have the greatest impact, it's really important for us to work with local partners with some of our programming, like our Great Lakes Plastic Cleanup, for example. We are facilitating a region-wide program along with some partners, another nonprofit in Canada. And then we work with local partners on the ground to operate technologies that we're putting in place. They're engaging their community. And so we have this sort of approach where we can go from the region-wide down to different local city, county levels, where mm-hmm. we're able to engage and impact on different levels. Yeah. And partnerships, is we wouldn't be able to do that without having those right partnerships in place.
Yeah, absolutely. And the expertise is out there, and your mandate is broad enough so that you need expertise in a lot of different sectors, I would think. So trying to replicate that in-house is expensive, and pulling funds raised, you know, away from potential beneficiaries, right? So even if you had to pay for partnerships, that might be more efficient than, you know, trying to cultivate your own in-house expertise.
Given the mission, the mandate of our work, yes, we'll need to grow. We'll need to have more in-house expertise, but we have collaboration in our DNA and its core, the partnerships mm-hmm. that we develop is core to achieving our mandate and advancing that work. And so we fundamentally believe that, you know, through those organizational partnerships and those local collaborations on projects, we can certainly get further faster on a lot of the work that we do, right?
Yeah. Like you suggested, Mark, it creates a tension because, you know, cultivating partnerships is tricky. And the more partners you have, the more you have to manage. But on the other hand, trying to do the reverse and garner all of your expertise from in-house seems like a nightmarish approach. So kudos to you guys for
it is. And I think, you know, you've touched on an important issue that I've learned in my time in the nonprofit sector. It can be just as competitive as the business sector in producing mm-hmm. goods and services. People are very protective of their mandates. They're very protective of their members. They're very protective of their funders. And we are trying to do things a little bit differently, because I think when we look at the size of the scale of the challenges in front of us, mm-hmm. there's no way we're going to achieve them fast enough without having the right kind of stakeholders and partners at the table. So we all have to come to the table with an equal interest in trying to bring our collective strengths to the conversation and trying to develop mm-hmm. the strategies, the actions, the projects that will meaningfully address some of the issues that we're facing. But mm-hmm. it is a bit of a different mindset, because the nonprofit sector, even though it's nonprofit, can be extremely competitive. And sometimes that gets in the way of some really important collaborations and partnerships and trying to solve problems.
Yeah. I thought when I left the private sector, and I was pretty high up at Lotus IBM at one point, I thought it'll be great to go to a nonprofit where things are less competitive and more collaborative and people aren't focused on shareholder value, but issues like social justice and economic goodness and et cetera. And I was partly right, but I was mostly wrong. Yeah, it's just, you know, people are the same, whether they're in a nonprofit or they're in a company that's working in the private sector. And, you know,
when you have limited, have limited funding to go around, there's a reason for that competitiveness. But I like to think that if we can find ways to complement each other, then we can still have that impact we're looking for without having to be too competitive.
Yeah. Nonprofits have donors. And the private sector has customers. If you don't do a good job at describing your work, marketing, we could say, in the nonprofit area, you lose your customers, you lose your donors. It's a little bit of a crass comparison, but there are a lot of more similarities than there are differences.
Yeah, I would also say that for the partners that have been involved in our work to date, they've really appreciated the format, the forum that we've provided. They've mm-hmm. really appreciated the fact that on a lot of issues, there's an ever-growing list of white papers and studies on this issue, to the point where we've kind of almost already overdone it in terms of over-diagnosing the issue. And I think a lot of mm-hmm. partners that we work with really want to start focusing on the doing part, the impact part. And I think ultimately, in trying to do that, we know that we need to have the best of academia at the table. We need to have companies that recognize the challenge and want to be a part of solving the problem. We want to have government voices there that know how to move this issue through government from a policy and legislative standpoint. I think that collaborative forum at the end of the day is going to become more of the norm, I think, just given the scale of the issues that we're trying to confront, whether it's locally, regionally, or even globally.
Yeah. Well, you guys are setting the example. So how do you gain alignment? Because alignment is so important for, you know, whether you're in the private sector or your nonprofit, so important for growth, for efficiency, for morale. How do you gain alignment when you have all of these different partners?
Yeah, maybe I'll start and Laura can add from a programming perspective. I think the first part is admitting that you've got a challenge, that you've got a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one issue that I can highlight as a recent example is the work we're doing around plastic waste and plastic litter and pollution. You know, I think globally we recognize that there was an issue, particularly in the Asia Pacific. I don't think there was a recognition in the US and Canada that we've got a plastic pollution problem in the Great Lakes. And so that's where we're able to translate some emerging science in our higher education institutions into the public domain to raise that awareness. I think it caught a lot of people by surprise. And then similarly, doing some additional research around how much waste we are generating as consumers and how much of it still has value, but is being lost to our landfills and not being circulated back into our economy. So I think the alignment came from doing some of that original research through our education partners, translating that, putting it out there in public domains. And once those numbers were really known, nobody could disagree with them. I think that's where we were able to start getting alignment, and through that, developing a strategy and action plan that either through policy or investment in infrastructure or engaging with consumers or looking at other solutions or activities, we could start to really understand, like, how do we start tackling this problem in the Great Lakes region? So I think the first part was in getting that alignment, was getting agreement on the nature of the challenge, the problem, mm-hmm. and then ultimately, where can we go from here collectively? Mm-hmm. Laura?
Laura, how about you?
Yeah, that piece on building our community that I mentioned, that's an important mm-hmm. part of it also. There's a lot of outreach and engagement with different sectors and different players to understand where they stand on issues, to make sure that we can bring that alignment. All of our programming is cross-border, cross-sector. We're bringing all those different perspectives and voices around the same table so that we can find that alignment moving forward.
Yeah. Yeah. My experience too is that if you get the earlier you can engage partners who are going to be impactful, the better educated everyone is, the more aware of viable solutions everyone is, you know, you're just creating an environment where tension's unavoidable, but maybe there's a little less friction, as opposed to bringing people in at the last minute where, you know, you might not. If you have a technology partner, for example, the technology partner might be able to suggest things or reveal things that are important in crafting the solution. So you can't, without, particularly with a complex agenda like you guys have, it seems like the early engagement and lots of engagement is terribly critical.
I would argue that our annual conference, which we've now renamed the Great Lakes Sustainable Growth Forum, has been a great opportunity, at least in person, to bring those different interests together to hear about some of the more pressing sustainability issues facing the region and to network, to build relationships. The goal is to then try and bring people together throughout the year to go deeper into those issues through that dialogue. That's where we try to create that alignment and ultimately the next steps in developing specific strategies and action plans to address them. But as you said, it's that engagement really early on and trying mm-hmm. to build that awareness and that trust and that relationship to try and to create the conditions for that dialogue and for that strategizing together in a collaborative way.
Absolutely. Trust and relationship. That's a big part of it. You said something earlier that I want to latch onto as well, the translation function. And serving as an intermediary that way between academic institutions and potentially everyone else. And the reason I think that's so important, I'd like to hear what you think about this, is scientists are often so bad at putting forward material that's understandable by the public. You know, and there have been a couple of great translators in the past. Carl Sagan reminds me of is one that I remember from a while ago. But talk a little bit about that, because we live in an age where people just don't believe stuff or believe whatever they want. And particularly in the arena of climate change, being able to translate the concerns and also how those environmental concerns are going to impact the economy or going to impact individual well-being.
I think to that piece, it's making sure, like, just knowing the audience and using the right language, the right terminology that speaks to them, because there's always common ground. So maybe instead of using climate change, you're talking about business resilience, but just using that right language, you can pull in a lot of partners and a lot of buy-in as long as you understand what's important to them and connect on those issues. Once you've done that, then you can start to broaden that conversation and hopefully maybe change some hearts and minds a little bit.
You know, I think our institutions have been set up, you know, the old saying, publish or perish, right? A lot of our bright minds in academia are doing a tremendous amount of research and science on applied issues and theoretical issues. And I think just the nature of their business tends to be a bit more insular, right? It happens within the walls of academia. That's not to say that they don't have really interesting perspectives and insights to share when given the opportunity. So we really do try to go out of our way to create a place where our academic partners and brightest minds can offer their opinions and perspectives alongside business and governments, whether it's our panels, whether it's our webinars, whether it's our policy research and programs. We try to provide that platform where they can easily engage. And in fact, we have another initiative called the Great Lakes Higher Education Consortium, where we're trying to build a network of institutions that share an interest in facilitating greater collaborations between the institutions, but also bringing their know-how and their science and the findings from that science out into more of the public domain and into the issues and the discussions that we have.
Yeah. Have either of you read any Robert Cialdini? He wrote a book, famous author about persuasion, you know, the art of persuasion and gaining alignment. And he just wrote a book called Persuasion. And Laura, without knowing it, you just cited a principle of persuasion, which is unity, you know, create the sense that you are not that different from the person who you are trying to persuade or educate, right? And so if you use the word climate change and you're talking to a climate denier, that's not going to be effective. But if you use the word business resilience or something, you know, So that's very good. Robert Cialdini is the author. What are the biggest challenges that you guys have faced, say, you know, since you came on board, Mark, or since you came on board, Laura? Name, cite two or three of the biggest challenges that you've had and how you dealt with them.
Well, for me, when I look back at 10 years, there's certainly things that I would have asked differently before taking on the job, right? And it was a new organization, right? So I knew that getting into it, but obviously for nonprofits, because I spent 80% of my time chasing money, you know, how much funding was there, is there to support your mission and your mandate, right? And I think it's a constant exercise in trying to find funders and donors that share in your vision, your mission, and you know, want to be a part of a shareholder and that impact that you're trying to create. So that funding piece is a constant challenge, right? And trying to scale and grow and have the right internal expertise, but also for a collaborative organization, like how much do you grow versus how much do you collaborate, right? And finding that balance is another area that we pay attention to quite a lot. And then I think the third one for me is board governance, believe it or not. We have a board that's run by volunteers. So trying to make sure that you've got the right skill sets on your board, that you've got the right engagement on your board is super important, because it is different than a private sector board, right? And so that board governance piece is something that I constantly think about and worry about, and we still don't have it, but it's been a work in progress for decades. And I think similarly, and we're unique in this way, you know, we can thank the IRS and the Canada Revenue Agency for this, but because we straddle the Canada-US border, you know, we need legal entities to operate in the US and we need legal entities to operate in Canada. And so for us, you know, how do we do that, but also have these organizations sort of working towards that overarching common vision and goal, right? And so how do you do that across different entities has certainly been both a challenge and an opportunity to figure out how do you work across an international border in a way that allows you to advance that mission and that mandate.
Yeah, you're in good company. Mark, everyone says that fundraising and board governance are, are challenging. I just had a guy on who was the executive board member at Mercy Corps when I was there as the CIO, CTO, and a brilliant fellow. And, he talked a lot about the board roles and how tricky that is and how important it is to get, as you put it, get the work in progress right. But it's also refreshing to hear you acknowledge that, because there's no such thing as a finished board, a finished organization. It's always better or worse, right? Mm-hmm. And particularly in the world, as quickly as it's changing, your board membership might need to be updated or expertise might need to be updated pretty regularly. So,
yeah. Well, it's constantly evolving, right? But I think for us, because we are a small organization, as Laura said, is how do we be mindful of the fact that we are small, but we're also trying to put in place the good governance that whether you're 5 people to 50 people to 100 people, you're following best practice. And best practice for a team of 5 people can be a lot when you're trying to organize that alongside the day-to-day impact stuff. And so I think, again, as we grow a little bit more, that work becomes a bit easier because you've got other expertise in-house that can help manage that. But most days, I'm the CEO, I'm the director of finance and accounting, and the chief development officer, we have a director of fundraiser, but we're all playing double-hatted, triple-hatted roles in many cases as an organization. Yeah. And so I think as we grow, one thing that I'm trying to pay attention a lot more to, especially since we're virtual, is, is employee well-being and making sure that as we grow, knowing that each and individual member of the team is probably doing their lion's share of the work plus more to make us successful, right? And that's just the challenge that comes with being a smaller nonprofit.
Yeah, and it comes with being remote.
Being remote, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, although in some ways for remote dynamics, the pandemic was not a bad thing. I hope no one takes that quote out of context. The pandemic was a terrible thing, but it was a challenge and it helped us grow in some ways. And the remote working aspect, I think more people feel comfortable doing this kind of thing, using Zoom to communicate. And you could still develop trust and rapport with employees if they're remote. So,
yeah, it's definitely harder. And Laura can probably attest
it's harder,
to that.
No question.
But it's definitely harder. And I think, again, you need to create those opportunities where you can be in person. And hopefully as we continue to grow and have more resources, we can find more opportunities to do that. Yeah. So we're kind of making the best of a virtual world as best we can.
Yeah. Yeah. Laura, how about you? What are the 3 biggest challenges or 2 or 3 that you've faced over the years you've been there?
Yeah, well, I would say, and I would certainly agree with Mark in terms of resources, just being a small team, and of course, always chasing funding. And with the ambitions that we have and the program areas that we're trying to develop, just how much can we do with the resources that we have? But showing that we're delivering something to those who are funding the work. So just trying to find that balance. And also, I think sometimes because we're ambitious, making sure that we're not trying to do too much and then we only are scratching the surface, because we do want to get to some depth. So trying to find that right balance of how wide, how deep to go with the programs as we're developing them and building them.
Yeah.
And then I would probably say communicating our impact, communicating what we're doing, making sure that over the last couple of years, we've done a really good job at starting to increase that communication to our audience, but making sure people know what we're actually do, why we're doing what we're doing, and how we're going to get to that goal and what we've accomplished so far. Because I think that we can do great work, but if people don't know what we're doing, then we're not going to be able to sort of grow that impact.
Yeah, great insights. And I like the challenge that you put forward, Laura, of going at the right depth, because obviously your agenda is very broad. But if you go too deep on one thing, then you've consumed all your resources or you're not balancing the entire agenda. So that must be a challenge for you guys.
Yeah, it is. But I think it's also important to understand what our stakeholders are looking for also. Mm-hmm. And so having those ongoing conversations with those who are funding us, but also those who are partnering with us on the work that we're doing, mm-hmm. making sure that we understand the expectations and how can we do that and still hit that mandate that we're looking at.
So given the challenge you just cited, do you guys believe in pilot projects? Do you run pilot projects?
I live and breathe by pilot projects.
That's good, dear.
Yeah. Yeah. Pilot projects fail fast, learn, yep. right? And really trying to, you know, from that, I think that's where we find out the best pathway forward on some issues. Just mm-hmm. for an example, right now, we just, with some funding, started up a pilot project looking at the secondary processing of flexible plastic packaging in films, you know, kind of a novel idea, small scale research unit that we were able to find and get started in the Chicago area. And hopefully projects like that will provide some pretty powerful data and some insights in terms of, you know, how do we think about recycling infrastructure more broadly in the Great Lakes region? So pilot projects mm-hmm. like that are super important for us to look at. How do we really solve some of these larger issues that we're facing across the region?
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Last question for you. What have you learned in terms of broad principles that you would offer up to a nonprofit leader? Maybe three principles that you would suggest to a nonprofit leader that would help them move forward and benefit from mistakes you might have made or things you've learned?
Well, I would say probably the first one that comes to mind is knowing your why, remembering your purpose, mm-hmm. because it's very easy to, you're everything if you're starting up. So keeping that why and that purpose at the core of everything mm-hmm. that you do. Also remembering that not everybody shares that why and that purpose. Mm-hmm. And so when engaging those that you need to make sure that you are communicating to them in terms that they can relate to and that they can get excited about. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, I think that would probably be sort of, I guess, the top two.
Those are great. So clarity on mission and vision, and then communicating, as you put it earlier, with your audience in mind, right?
Exactly.
Communicating about what you do and generating excitement to different groups in a way that's absorbable, I guess. Yeah.
Right.
Mark, how about you? What would you put forward?
Yeah, it's a great question, and certainly cannot argue with the advice that Laura has given. I think it's spot on. You know, I think one of the best books I read sort of 3 or 4 years in was Getting to Maybe. I don't know if you've heard before.
Oh, sure.
But I think I've read that 2 or 3 times. And I still think that we're getting to maybe, even after 10 years. To Laura's point, what has been important, and I think it would have been even more important on day one, is just having that clarity of vision, that clarity of message, where you can go to some early adopters to say, hey, if you believe in the work that we're trying to do, can you give us 4 to 5 years worth of runway funding wise to give us the time and the space to create and to breathe and to really build a platform for success. I think that that's important, is to have that runway. I think my job was 1,000 times harder knowing that I was starting with $10,000 in the bank and it wasn't clear sort of who was with us along that journey. I think that's certainly become more clear over the last 10 years, and particularly since we put out our new strategic plan and solving for sustainability. So I think, again, it's having that clarity and that message, and it's finding a group of partners who believe in that and who are willing to give you a long enough runway to get off the ground as a nonprofit. There mm-hmm. are some issues that it's easy to pull people around, like certain causes or whatever. But because ours was so broad in terms of the economy, the environments, the Great Lakes region, Canada, US, I think that those partnerships needed to be a bit more defined early on, and to get them rallying behind the work that we were doing and to create that time and that space with the funding to grow, right? But I think we're finally getting there, even after a decade. But I still think we're, in many ways, we're still getting to maybe, and maybe that's just a constant. That's going to be a constant throughout this career and throughout the work that we do.
Yeah. Well, you know, as Pema Chodron says, start somewhere, start somewhere, you know, and
That's
make
right.
progress. And good stuff takes time.
It does.
So I've heard from a lot of nonprofit leaders, I've heard patience, setting expectations, both things you just talked about, Mark.
You just reminded me of an important point is there are, and it's really hard to see this in the moment. It's only when you really look back retrospectively that you can see it and understand it, is that there are going to be extreme highs and there are going to be extreme lows in the nonprofit world. And I think it's just understanding where you are in that growth as an organization and just having some perspective. It's just trying to step back from yourself and just say, oh, okay, like this is a natural cycle. I know where I am. And don't be afraid to talk to other mentors, to other organizations. People are always willing to give advice, but just that it's a natural thing to have a high, to have a low, to be somewhere in the middle, and just be able to step back, have perspective at any given moment about where you are in your work and your journey as an organization. Because you will get all of the feelings in the nonprofit space. And that's one of the most rewarding, I think, aspect of it. And but I do think it can be struggling for nonprofit leaders, particularly small, medium-sized nonprofits, if they just get caught up too much by those lows and those highs, and they're not able to balance those feelings and those pressures and those anxieties on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you, Mark. You. Thank you, Laura. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you both. And please let me know if there's anything I can do to help out CGLR.
We're always looking for a dollar, Chip.
Okay. And where should people who are interested in supporting you, where should they plug in on the website?
Or? Yeah, for sure. Okay. Yeah. So it's councilofthegreatlakesregion.org. We are just in the process of overhauling it over the next month or so. But councilofthegreatlakesregion.org is where people can learn more about our work and to learn about how they can get involved in our work.
Great. Well, it's been the optimism you guys have is palpable, and it's been really fun talking with you.
Thanks, Chip.
Thanks so much, Chip.
Okay, take care.
All right.
You too.
Bye.